This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and in this week's episode, I'll be talking to two Russia experts on the country's hidden fragility. I'll be asking, is Putin's game plan just to survive on luck?
In traditional critique of Russia, one reads that Russia is evil, somehow a threat to us and our way of life. At the same time, it's a basket case, which is stagnating. And I often feel when reading such things, well, make up your mind, which is it? Are they a dangerous threat with the power to overthrow us, or their basket case?
We'll also be getting to the bottom of Trump's tariffs. Are they good or bad?
I think the esteemed Matt Ridley has an error in his analysis of the history. In fact, very, very few reputable economists think that Smoot-Hawley had very much to do with the Great Depression, much less caused World War II. And in fact, Washington, Hamilton, Henry Clay, Abraham Lincoln, every Republican president up to Dwight Eisenhower protected American manufacturing.
And last, is kindness the answer to the world's current problems? I talked to Cosmo Landesman and kindness expert Gabriella Van Rey.
Take that one moment, one person, one kindness to be the difference in that moment. And I believe that that creates a ripple effect, that creates safer communities. And the explanation to that, Cosmo, is when you do that, you have no idea what that leaves in that man or that woman that you've affected.
The World Cup is due to start in a week, and as the streets of Moscow are cleaned up in preparation, things seem to be going pretty well for Putin's Russia. Russia has been asked to fill the void left by Trump in the Iran nuclear deal. Russophile parties are wreaking havoc to the EU establishment across Europe, and Russia's involvement in Syria has established the country as a serious power broker in the region. But in this week's cover story, Owen Matthews writes that Putin is surfing on borrowed luck, and sooner or later it will run out. Owen joins me now on the podcast, together with Christopher Granville, former diplomat and a Russia expert at TS Lombard. So Owen, you start in your piece by outlining what Putin wants the world to believe about Russia. What sort of image do you think we're going to see presented to us during the World Cup?
Well, I think it's going to be exactly the same kind of image that Putin's become so terribly good at projecting. These sort of gigantic sporting showpieces are exactly what authoritarian regimes do very well. I think it's going to be very safe. I was in a taxi a few days ago, and the driver was saying that his brother was frightened to go to Russia. And I said, well, the point about a police state is that it is full of police. One thing it will be is very secure. It's going to be very lavish, just like the Sochi Olympics. It's Putin's way of showing off to the world. So he spared no expense in making it an incredibly grand and well-organized affair. And that's really the genius of Putin, actually, is what makes him one of the most remarkable statesmen of modern times, is that he has done such a fantastic job of projecting the illusion or the image of enormous wealth, stability and power, which is not necessarily underpinned by the fundamentals.
Well, I mean, you say in your piece that beneath all this patriotic hype, Russia's in fact crumbling. So what is causing Russia to crumble?
Well, very simply, it's the economy is actually stagnant. I mean, they've had a gigantic cash inflow thanks to many years of oil prices, which began taking off shortly after Putin took power in 2000 and then rose with a few dips, but remained really basically fundamentally high for all of Putin's tenure. The last 4 years have been a bit of have seen an oil price crash. But while Russia has had a massive windfall of oil money, its GDP has actually remained more or less static, whereas China's since 2000 has nearly quadrupled, America's has nearly doubled. So in fact, what we're seeing is a very dysfunctional, stagnant economy, but the dysfunction is camouflaged by this tidal wave of cash that allows Putin to splurge on things like the World Cup.
And Christopher, is this a picture that you recognise, that Russia is crumbling?
Well, I have a reputation perhaps as an optimist on Russia, but I regard myself as a boring middle-of-the-road man. I mean, it's not crumbling, but it's not booming either. It's not stagnant. After a nasty little two-year recession following the oil price crash, which Owen just mentioned, in 2014, they've now gone back into growth. it's unexciting growth. It's, it was 1.5% real GDP gain last year compared to the year before. And this year, perhaps a bit faster, but nothing to write home about. So it's a story of macro stability, exemplary macroeconomic policies, fiscal and monetary, which would make one of Margaret Thatcher's dry cabinet ministers proud. And it is a, but at the same time, it's very far from, as Owen just said, a booming Asian economy. And President Putin has set the main strategic goal for the new six-year presidential term to which he's just been elected as to raise Russia's growth rate to no lower than the global average, which, depending on what your view of the Chinese economy is going to be something like 3.5%. It's a very long way. It's doubling the present rate of growth. To do that is going to be extremely tough, and you can't be too optimistic about that. But if I can just pick up one of Owen's other points, I would argue with the idea that the oil price has been the driver of Russia's prosperity under Putin, or the sole driver. I think that's an oversimplification. For a start, the oil price rose in Putin's first two terms, but probably only accounted for about half of the doubling of GDP which occurred in that period, the 2000s. The other bit was simply stability allows a productive use of assets. It's productivity. So the living standards of the Russian population doubled in that period after a decade of sharp dislocation and hardship following the collapse of the communist system. So no wonder he was popular. The last 10 years have been much less good. Growth has, if you count the recession of recent years, has more or less stagnated. But nevertheless, it's now recovering again. So, I mean, Owen writes that Putin owes it all to luck rather than judgment. The boring middle-of-the-road view has to be a bit of both, and you make your own luck, and he's done a bit of that as well.
The one thing I would say is that actually I wouldn't disagree also that there was a lot of real economic growth in the first Putin two terms. But I think one of the problems is that actually the main wellspring of that growth was access to international financing and investment. And one of the problems of this latest Putin term is that thanks to sanctions, the access to foreign capital, international capital, has become much more difficult, and the investment climate has deteriorated dramatically. But where the luck comes in is that just when things were, when Putin was about to face a cash crunch, he's suddenly been rescued once again by this windfall of rising oil prices. So just to be clear, I agree with you that it's not all about oil, but nonetheless, he has been devilishly lucky in experiencing an oil windfall just when he needed it most, and that's now.
And you also mentioned in your piece Syria. How important has that been for Putin's luck or judgment?
Well, Syria, again, is a brilliant example of how Putin has been extremely canny in parlaying actually a very tiny investment of military force and blood and treasure into gigantic diplomatic dividends. I mean, whatever the opprobrium that's been heaped on him in the Western press about the destruction of Aleppo and his support for the regime of Assad, what's clear is that Putin, in getting involved in a conflict which the West didn't really want to touch, has actually been able to reap enormous diplomatic leverage from it, because Russia, just because of his very effective deployment of just one squadron of planes, 35 planes at Khmeimim Air Base, was able to turn the tide of the war and also cast Russia as a major power broker in the Middle East. I mean, compared to the disaster of the trillions of dollars and thousands of American lives that have been spent in the Iraq intervention, and you know, America actually received strategic disaster in many ways, certainly in terms of its of increased Iranian influence and so on in the region. It was exactly the rule of unintended consequences. Whereas Russia, with just a tiny force, has actually projected itself into the peace process, when this the Syrian peace process, which Russia has taken over effectively, and Putin has accomplished exactly what he set out to accomplish, which is he doesn't, I don't think, really fundamentally care about whether Assad lives or dies. What he cares about is Russia's prestige in the region and the world, and he's been incredibly effective at doing that.
My only gloss would be to observe that another reason for this success, which Owen has described, is that President Putin and the Russian diplomatic service have kept good relations with all players in the region. If you contrast the United States and its allies, which are very partisan and sectarian, they're fully aligned with the Sunni bloc led by Saudi Arabia and with Israel. Russia, at first sight, is on the other side of the barricades. It's supporting the quasi-Shia Assad regime in Syria and is very closely aligned with Iran, which is the big regional Shia power, which is fighting on the ground in the Syrian civil war on the side of the Assad regime. But also, Russia has strong relations and constructive relations with Israel and Saudi Arabia. Israel is a massive Russian diaspora there and a very strong interest in good relations with Israel. And with Saudi Arabia, there's the shared interest in supporting the oil price and very, very important and successful cooperation since late 2016 on the oil price. So this is why you've got a balanced and effective diplomacy, which, although anyone can come a cropper in the Middle East at any stage, and even now, Russia will be lucky to avoid serious problems in that region, just as all external players who put their fingers into the pot are making themselves vulnerable. But nevertheless, it's a blinder compared to which Putin has played, compared to his strategic rivals in the West. The main thing I take issue with in Owen's piece is the idea that Putin's goal is to divide Europe, to weaken Europe, to undermine our system. The Soviets wanted us all to be communist. Putin wants the whole of Europe to be authoritarian like him. I think that's a misunderstanding. He sees Europe as conducting an economic war against Russia, and he is conducting influence operations all over the place to try to support anyone in Europe who might be more friendly to Russia, who might contribute to the lifting of sanctions. He wants Europe to be prosperous. Of course he does. He's quite economically literate, unlike our own political leaders, as you can see in the Brexit process. He understands very well that strong growth in Europe is extremely good for Russia. And what he wants is to have these sanctions lifted. And now there's a government in Italy which has come to office last week, which is formally committed to easing or lifting the sanctions against Russia. The sanctions against Russia imposed by the European Union require unanimity. Italy is far too large a member state of the European Union to be battered aside. And therefore, there is a chance that will happen. In traditional critique of Russia, one reads that Russia is evil, somehow a threat to us and our way of life. At the same time, it's a basket case, which is stagnating. And I often feel when reading such things, well, make up your mind, which is it? Are they a dangerous threat with the power to overthrow us, or their basket case? And when I sometimes ask people about that, they say, oh, well, yeah, they are a basket case, but rather like the dying Hollywood monster. You know, as it dies, it may lash out and cause us harm. And I think that that's far-fetched. But I'd agree with Owen only insofar as, you know, if you're in trouble, then the temptation of a foreign adventure is there. I don't see that in Putin's track record. The military campaign in Georgia was conducted at a time of total boom in Russia. Russia had never been more prosperous than it was in August 2008. The Crimea-Ukraine crisis was not a premeditated conspiracy to find an alibi for Russia's stagnating growth. It was a Falklands event where it just happened very fortuitously for Putin at that time. But there we are. It's neither a basket case nor a huge threat. It's a developing country with a ton of problems, but with quite a cautious and economically very responsible leadership.
I would just add one thing, just to pick up on Chris's Falklands factor point, which is extremely apposite. The good news about this whole situation of Putin now enjoying an oil windfall is that he now won't have to conjure another Falklands factor to keep himself in power, and that's good news for the world.
Thank you, Christopher and Owen.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellar plan.
Last week, Trump announced a fresh round of tariffs on aluminium and steel, targeting the EU, Canada, and Mexico. G7 leaders have expressed their anger ahead of the group's summit this weekend, with counter-tariffs already planned. But is there really no rhyme or reason to Trump's tariffs, as many are suggesting? Daniel McCarthy, the editor of American magazine Modern Age, defends Trump's decision in this week's magazine, and he has it out with Matt Ridley, author of The Rational Optimist. Matt joins me now, along with John Carney, the economics editor for Breitbart. So Matt, can I start by asking you to briefly outline your argument in this week's magazine as to why you think Trump's tariffs are a bad idea?
Yes, mainly because tariffs are always a bad idea. We know this from history. They've tended to produce disastrous results for countries in the past, whereas free trade has tended to do the opposite. Think of Hong Kong in the modern age or Britain in the Corn Law era versus what happened with Smoot-Hawley in 1930 in America, which set off a trade war that ended in real war and depression along the way. And we know this because if you impose tariffs, you are effectively punishing your own people. You're blockading your own harbours, as Joan Robinson, the economist, put it. Because your people are consumers, and a lot of them use something like steel to produce other goods, and if you'll just push up the price of it, etc. And you're not only punishing your enemies, you're also punishing yourselves. And there is no reason to think this won't be, and it will be any different this time. And in fact, we've already seen the beginning of retaliation from Europe and Mexico to these tariffs, which mean that the effect is going to be even worse, even without taking into account the effect on American consumers. So I think free trade is always a good idea, protectionism is always a bad idea, and the concept of a trade war is plain wrong. There is no such thing as a winner in a trade war.
John, do you think they're a good idea, Trump's tariffs?
I do think they are a very good idea. And I think the esteemed Matt Ridley has an error in his analysis of the history. In fact, very, very few reputable economists think that Smoot-Hawley had very much to do with the Great Depression, much less caused World War II. And in fact, Washington, Hamilton, Henry Clay, Abraham Lincoln, every Republican president up to Dwight Eisenhower protected American manufacturing. The Republican Party was actually traditionally the party of high tariffs. American economic expansion leading up to World War II was, and through the 1950s, was behind a tariff wall. We built the world's most prosperous and most capitalist nation behind a tariff wall. So this idea that you cannot win with tariffs is frankly wrong. But I'd also say that if Matt Ridley were right, then we should see no tariff retaliation at all. If tariffs are effectively blockading your own harbors, then the rest of the world should be very happy with the United States building up its own tariffs, because we would be blockading ourselves and they should just unilaterally lower their own tariff barriers. The fact that they will not do this, and that as Mr. Ridley has said, that there will be a retaliation against it, tells you that tariffs might have something going for them.
Well, on that point, I think just because the rest of the world is benighted about this doesn't mean that that you can learn any lessons from that. In other words, it's true that most of the rest of the world thinks in this mercantilist, zero-sum way. The European Union has been particularly at fault for thinking that it's better off to have an external tariff around its borders all this time. We've got one really good example of a country that once said, hang on a minute, let's not care whatever anyone else does, even if they put up tariffs, we'll just get rid of ours. It was the UK in the 1840s and then in the 1860s under Gladstone, and it led to a huge prosperity. And the argument had been won by people like Richard Cobden in the years up to that. Hong Kong has done something very similar in this era. It has no tariffs on anything that's imported into it. It's got a few taxes on goods, but it makes no distinction between whether they're made by foreigners or made by Hong Kong Chinese people. And it has had the fastest growth of pretty well any country in the world over the last 50 years. So I think John's right that the retaliation implies that we think that we can win a trade war over this side of the Atlantic too, but I think we're just as wrong as Trump on that.
John, Matt just obviously suggested that Trump's tariffs are actually only going to end up punishing his own people, his own voters. Do you think that's fair?
No, I don't. In fact, I think that particularly the steel and aluminum tariffs are absolutely a necessity for a free and independent country. We have a choice. It's a very stark choice. And it is between having a steel and aluminum industry that is healthy, vibrant, can attract new workers, and can protect American independence for generations to come, or we cannot have a steel industry and be reliant on foreign countries for our steel and aluminum. I'm glad Matt brought up Britain in the 1840s. In fact, what happened was Britain became so reliant on imports that by the early 20th century, it was almost taken out entirely by a few dozen German submarines. It weakened Great Britain rather than strengthened it. The United States, no matter who we are importing our steel and aluminum from, cannot afford, and the world cannot afford, for the United States to become dependent on foreign sources of steel, regardless of what country they come from, whether it is from Canada, whether it is from Europe or China. It makes no sense. You can't have a free country that is dependent on, for very important economic resources, on foreign imports.
Yeah, the problem with that argument is that pretty well everybody thinks that their industry is strategic, and that you can't, you have to make it at home because it, what happens if the U-boats come back? And by the way, I don't think the U-boats are going to surround America anytime soon, let alone in the St. Lawrence between America and Canada, because one of these tariffs is against Canada. So steel is a very important input to lots of industries in the United States. Cars, ships, iPhones have all got steel in them. And all you're doing by these tariffs is pushing up the price, and therefore pushing up the price for consumers. You're hurting American consumers, but you're also making American producers less competitive in a lot of these industries, which are also quite strategic industries. I mean, I don't think America could survive long without memory chips or food or all sorts of other things if there were a war and a U-boat blockade. So, I mean, it's true that Britain as a trading nation was vulnerable to submarine warfare in the 20th century, but it survived on both occasions, and it would have been far less able to survive if it hadn't been prosperous. So I do think that this is a shooting of yourself in the foot. It's very hard to find reputable economists who argue that tariffs increase prosperity generally. They can protect the jobs of some people in some industries for short periods, but the idea that that China is going to end this process of dumping, giving Americans access to cheap goods by suddenly cornering the market in steel and driving up the price is very unrealistic. Steel is made all over the world. It'd be very difficult for any one country to suddenly strategically use its dominance in steel exports to America to punish American citizens.
John, how much of this is about China? In Dan's piece, he suggests that the tariffs make sense if you see it as a response to China's growing might. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I do. I think that it is absolutely true that China is the OPEC of steel. It produces so much steel that it is the swing supplier of steel to the world. It is the price setter of steel to the world because of its oversupply, the same way that Saudi Arabia and OPEC more generally are to oil. We saw in the 1970s the U.S. economy hurt by the fact that it was so dependent on foreign oil that when OPEC decided it wanted to increase the prices of oil and decrease the supply, you wound up with huge gas shortages. This wasn't, again, you know, there was no blockade. It was just something that the swing supplier of oil decided to accomplish in order to punish the United States for policies they didn't like. This is very, very much something that could happen with China, and it goes beyond steel, frankly. It's because China will not just exercise its power over steel. It is seeking, and it is very clear about this, global economic dominance in a number of industries, whether it's electric cars, microchips, solar panels. And it wants the world to be reliant on it, particularly because it believes that the reliance on China will then also give it political, economic hegemony will lead to political hegemony. That is not a crazy view on China's part. We've seen that the economic hegemon of the world, the world's biggest market, the United States, has also become the political hegemon. And so the question facing the United States, but the entire world, is, will we acquiesce to China's plans, or will we resist?
it's worth remembering that America is producing more manufacturing goods by value in real terms today than at any time in its history. So the idea that China's rise has led to a collapse of American manufacturing is simply not true. It's America has shifted from relatively low value goods where it's not doesn't have a comparative advantage to ones where it does have a comparative advantage, as you'd expect in an era of trade. But China did try. I mean, I think John's right that China sees it in this corporatist way as sort of part of national security, or rather the Chinese government does. But actually, that's not what trade is. Trade is an individual in America deciding to buy something which is manufactured by a bunch of individuals in a firm in China. Why should an American individual be told he can't buy something just because it's made by foreigners rather than, I mean, you don't tell people that you can't buy things made in different states. Why should it matter if they're made in different countries? That seems to me the essence of the sort of open world argument that is crucial here. And the fact that breast-beating politicians on the national stage talk about trade as if it was an element of security policy and warfare, like Donald Trump does and like the Chinese leadership does, is noises off that we should be prepared to ignore.
And John, finally, can I just ask you, in Daniel's piece, he says that this protectionism is designed to help Trump in the November midterm elections. Do you think it will be a good political move for him?
I do think that the American people have wisened up to what was called free trade, but in fact resembles nothing like free trade. Remember what free trade in its theoretical idea is, that it has these widespread benefits and protectionism supposedly has widespread costs, but very disparate and distinct winners in it. In fact, what we've seen is that what has gone under the mantle of free trade has had very widespread costs and very distinct concentrated winners. This implies that we don't have a system of free trade in the world at all. So it's almost a shadow argument taking place. What Donald Trump is saying is that since we do not have free trade in the world, since it does not exist, the United States should take care of its own, which is what every other country in the world has been doing while disguised as free trade.
Thank you, Matt, and thank you, John. And now for something a little bit kinder. In this week's issue, Cosmo Landesman says that suddenly being kind to others is the new rock and roll. But can kindness really save the world? Cosmo joins me now, along with Gabriella Van Rey, a kindness expert. So Cosmo, when did you first start to notice this new trend?
Well, it's slowly been emerging over the last couple of years. I keep noticing newspaper headlines with things like "Science proves that kindness is the key to personal happiness" or "Personal growth." And I even read one headline that said "Kindness can cure your cold." And I began to think, well, you know, I'm all for kindness, but aren't we making rather exaggerated claims?
Gabriella, do you think kindness is the answer to everything?
No, definitely no. So I definitely agree with you, Cosmo. But I do think that the lack of kindness in our lives have devastating effects. And we have to realize that someone's cause hides their greatest adversity.
Cosmo, do you think we live in particularly unkind times?
Yes, and that's what my point is. I think we do need more kindness in our daily lives and in our political discussions in our culture, but I don't think that's very different. I mean, I believe in the old-fashioned kind of kindness between individuals as a kind of private, spontaneous act that we do on our daily lives. What I'm against is the idea that that kindness can solve everything, not only in our personal level, but in our cultural and political level now. There's the whole politics of kindness that if we just nice to one person, they'll be nice to four people, then four more people will be kind, and suddenly we'll have this wonderful, kind world. But if we look around, it hasn't happened yet.
I agree with you. It hasn't happened because I don't think we're understanding what kindness is in reality. And so I agree with you about the old-fashioned kind, but you know, these groups have spurted out of nothing in the United States that talk about random acts of kindness. And I think I'm much more in sync with you, actually,
right.
Is that I like the purposeful acts of kindness, where you actually go out of your way to talk and include the people that are in your 2 mile radius that you forget on a daily basis. But I think, you know, honestly, Cosmo, I think like any trending word, I think people jumped on it and they just went, oh my God, I love this. My cause is, I'm just going to say, for example, my cause is homelessness or my cause is hunger. And now I add the word kindness to it and maybe it just makes it all better. Now, scientifically, I have no proof, just like you said. There is no real hard proof. But I do feel that the kindness that we're talking about, the kindness that is the value, that brings the values back, the old-fashioned values, that's the one we need to concentrate on. That's the one we need.
I agree, but the old idea of kindness was something you did as an end in itself. It wasn't meant to have a specific payoff for you. You didn't get to feel virtuous and wonderful by being kind. It was a thing that you did because it was the right thing to do. It was a sensitive, empathetic thing to do, as opposed to, oh, I'm going to do this because it will boost my immune system. It will make me feel better about myself. Everyone will love me. That's what I think is wrong.
Absolutely. But you know that I must honestly say when I do an act of kindness to another human being, which I don't splatter all over social media that I've done that, by the way. But when I do that, when I walk out of the situation, I myself, and I really express this to people on stage, I feel an inch taller myself, not because I received a reward, but because I saw what it did to that person.
Cosmo, you also mentioned in your piece you've been keeping a kindness diary. Can you tell us what that involves?
Well, my kindness diary began in one of my 300 New Year's resolutions for self-improvement. And I just thought it'd be a good thing to try and be a little kinder, not make a big song and dance out of it, but keep a record that way because you can forget about it. So I kept the diary every time I did either a small act of kindness or a larger act of kindness.
What kind of things would that involve?
Would be talking to people who were often ignored. There was a very disturbed man on a bench the other day I encountered who no one would speak to, and I'd try to calm him down. Or I would bring somebody some food, or, you know, just small little things, opening doors. You know, they range all sorts of things. But the idea that these acts would make me feel better about myself was in fact... They didn't actually. I felt the same. It hasn't altered my life. I'm the same miserable me as I was before.
Gabriella, you're obviously a kindness expert. I mean, what does that involve? And are you a particularly kind person, do you think?
I think I am a particularly kind person, but I want to make a big distinction between nice and kind. When Cosmo says opening doors, I call that nice, like etiquette. Right? We have etiquette in our lives that should be there, should be taught, but the truth is it's not always, right? Do you agree, Cosmo?
I agree with that. I think that distinction is important, yes.
Yeah. And we do not make that distinction. So when I speak in public, I make that distinction very clear. So holding up a door, I do not think a child needs to be patted on the back and get a ribbon. Literally, because, you know, in America, we give ribbons.
That's just good manners. Is that what you're saying? It's just good manners as opposed to kindness.
Yeah, because that's good manners. We need to learn it from home. We need to learn it from school. And we get no reward for having good manners.
Right.
But kindness, and this is truly my slogan, is something that you see. So you take, so Cosmo took that one moment to notice the man on the bench. See, because the truth is, he could have not noticed. And that doesn't make him an unkind person. That just makes him a nice person that, you know, when asked, he will do something. But for me, kindness is that he went out of his way to notice that ignored man on the bench and to do something, whatever came spontaneous to him. Talk to him, offer him a cup of coffee, whatever it was. Right, Cosmo?
That's correct.
And to me, that is kindness. Take that one moment, one person, one kindness to be the difference in that moment. And I believe that that creates a ripple effect that creates safer communities. And the explanation to that, Cosmo, is when you do that, you have no idea what that leaves in that man or that woman that you've affected.
Just finally, can I ask you both to tell me your most recent act of kindness, apart from obviously being kind enough to come on our podcast. Cosmo?
Well, my most recent act of kindness was a person I found, a very disturbed alcoholic on this park bench that was screaming his head off and no one would speak to him. And I went to speak to him and I calmed him down and I discovered he was someone I knew 20 years ago.
Oh, wow, Cosmo, that's fantastic.
I don't know how my conversation, I might have driven him to more drink. I don't know what the actual results would have been, but I hope he felt inspired by it.
And Gabriella?
For me, it's pretty simple. Living in California, I am called often a Mexican or an immigrant that comes from either Mexico or the Middle East and that I should go home. And instead of answering, no, I'm not, and defending myself, what I did the other day is I said, I am. What is wrong with that? And, you know, I opened a conversation. And we actually talked for quite a long time in the middle of the street. And like Cosmo, I might not have convinced him of anything. And that was not my point. My only point was to show him that if I was from that country, I shouldn't defend myself. And that we are who we are. And to take maybe a little bit of education in learning that we can't say that all people from one culture are bad.
Thank you, Cosmo, and thank you, Gabriella. If you enjoyed this podcast, do please subscribe, rate, and review on the iTunes store. We'd love to hear from you. And do pick up this week's issue to read all of the pieces discussed, as well as pieces from Steve Bannon on Italy's election, Hannah Stewart on female jihadis, and much more. We've also got a special offer for podcast listeners. Simply go to spectator.co.uk/podoffer to pick up 12 issues of The Spectator for only £12, as well as a limited edition Moleskine notebook. Thank you for listening, and do join us again next week.